As we looked at this, I talked with Mike Anderson, and he told me about the work that Levette Cavis, he goes by Lev, I guess, whatever you want to be called, was doing on maximum precipitation, because we've heard this idea of probable maximum precipitation. We know that it is a measure that the engineers who design dams are interested in, that they can pass that level of a flood without losing the dam. For example, at Folsom Dam, if you cannot get all the water through the spillway for the problem of maximum flood, where's it going to go? Well, it's going to go over the other part of the dam, which is not concrete, which is a lot of packed earth, engineered packed earth, but even engineered packed earth with water flowing over it will what? Erode and go away. So if the big flood came and you couldn't pass the problem of maximum flood, the water would then damage the dam, and then when the next flood came, you would have no dam at all. So these become important concepts as we think about flood risk management in Sacramento and other communities. And so some work done here at UC Davis is very kind of cutting edge, I think, for how we can think about that. And Lev Cavis from here is going to share his work. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary, for this opportunity to present some preliminary results on our ongoing work on the maximum precipitation over American River Basin. I'll be focusing today on the December 96, January 97 flood event. Basically on the American River Basin. This particular presentation is mainly from the paper that you have in the proceedings that was published in the Journal of Hydrologic Engineering last year. The study area, the American River watershed. Where are we coming from? What's the purpose of the study? As was already mentioned by several previous speakers, the issue is, are there, some physical limits to the precipitation and ensuing floods, over well-defined basins? And in that light, actually, when one looks at the literature, one finds, some very interesting, results and directions that have already been laid out as early as 1940s. Even during the Second World War, there are studies that were jointly basically performed between U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and U.S. Weather Bureau, which basically culminated in a paper in the Transactions of the American Geophysical Union by Paul Huss and Gilman in 1953. This series of studies is really a true testament to the American ingenuity towards developing a viable engineering design for the large hydraulic structures with very, very substantial financial implications. What is in those reports, really, and in the paper, is in fact a well thought out course of action, a well thought out approach as to how to approach these maximum possible probable maximum precipitation, trying to basically determine some of these physical limits. So what happened was these engineers and atmospheric scientists, knowing what they had to do, actually could not do the things that they envisioned. And the reason for that was the lack of numerical atmospheric models at that time, the state of the science in atmospheric sciences, and, of course, the lack of computer power at the time. So they try to approximate the general methodology that they envisioned by means of some approximations. So I just tried to summarize the traditional PMP, probable maximum precipitation estimation procedure, as is laid out in Paulhus and Gilman and some of the hydrometeorological reports, basically selecting, you know, if there's a target basin, selecting the historical severe storms over that basin, then for each of those storms, moisture maximization in terms of the precipitable water, and if they don't find a sufficient number of these severe storms to transpose some other severe storms that might have happened in basins of similar meteorological characteristics, and then making adjustments for the elevation and the barriers, and then trying to extrapolate the results from the point location to various size areas and various size durations. So that was basically the methodology that was laid out. Of course, this particular methodology, because of, you know, the limitations that I have already mentioned, made some important approximations, such as approximating the precipitation to the basically proportional, you know, to the precipitable water, and then estimating the precipitable water based on the dew point temperature and assuming that there is a basically a saturated pseudo-adiabatic lapse rate, you know, from the surface, you know, to the top of the atmosphere. And then there were these storm transpositions, again, you know, approximating, you know, the storms by some of the severe storms that had happened in other areas. These approximations were necessary due to the lack of a regional atmospheric model and lack of computer power to transform the necessary numerical computations within reasonable time frames. One specially important aspect, really, is the wind field. The wind field, as we are going to see, you know, from some of the analysis that was done for the 96-97 storm, is really crucial in characterizing the moisture inflows to a target basin. For that purpose, I'll just like to focus on the December 26, 96 to January 3, 97 heavy precipitation event over northern California with focus on American River. And why 96-97? Well, again, as is well known, 96-97 event actually gave the largest, the highest precipitation, two-month precipitation depth for the among the storms from 1920 to May 2007, when the National Weather Service California Nevada River Forecast Center report that this particular table was taken was published. And then, you know, when we look at another study, which was done by the Oregon Climate Service, we can see, again, for the December 29, 96 to January 3, 97 period, we can see very heavy precipitation over the Feather, Yuba, and American River watersheds region, basically reaching amounts as high as 30 inches. Over American River at the Blue Canyon gauge, the six-day total from 12/29/96 to 1/3/97 reached about 28 inches. Now, what is happening, you know, with respect to the synoptic climatology for this particular event versus the general climatology? Well, again, this is from the National Weather Service California Nevada RFC report. This analysis, by the way, was done by the Earth Systems Research Laboratory, Physical Sciences Division. And you can see that during this December 26, January 3 period, the climatology basically shows this upper jet stream basically starting over East Asia and reaching about the international date line. And we can see the precipitable water field is basically reaching about, you know, the international date line. Whereas during this December 26, 96 to January 3, 97, we can see basically the upper jet stream extending all the way from East Asia to the Pacific Northwest. And similarly, the moisture basically field also extending all the way to the Pacific Northwest and Northern California. If one again looks at the analysis of the Earth System Research Laboratory for January 1st, 97 precipitable water field, one can clearly see the sources of moisture. One source of moisture is again on the western side of the Pacific, basically at about 20 degrees north, basically extended to the Hawaiian Islands, and then another source of moisture coming from the tropics in the north direction, again towards Hawaiian Islands, and then converging near Hawaiian Islands, and then moving in the north east direction towards California and the Northwest Pacific. And what is really interesting is that you can see here that this precipitable water is reaching amounts as high as 40 millimeters, in fact, in here, 45 millimeters. So what has this particular event shown? Well, one thing that it has shown is that the phase of precipitation is important. Again, when one reads the analysis, one sees that in the analysis, it's mentioned, you know, that the warm rain on the already existing snowpack over the Sierras led to substantial snowmelt and consequent high flows. There were some very heavy snowfall just previous to this December 26, January 3 event. Therefore, you know, it was basically, you know, the conditions were ripe, you know, for snowmelt, and then, you know, we got this warm rain. The second important issue is the wind field. The wind field with respect to its trajectory and speeds is important to the moisture inflow into the target watershed. So within this framework, how can we look at this particular problem? Well, in mathematical physics, the evolution of a storm over a region may be considered as an initial boundary value problem. So within this framework, the evolution of a historical severe storm over a target watershed can be simulated by means of a numerical model, a numerical atmospheric model, that will solve the pertinent dynamics and thermodynamics, atmospheric dynamics and thermodynamics, under the appropriate initial and boundary value conditions. So these initial conditions and boundary conditions actually are available and may be provided by the historical ANSEP-NCAR reanalysis data that is available all the way from 1948 to present. Although this data is rather coarse at about 2.5 degree grid resolution, which is about 280 kilometers over California. So in order to solve this initial boundary value problem, we need a numerical model. The numerical model we are using here is what's called the fifth generation mesoscale model, MM5, from National Center for Atmospheric Research and Penn State University, NCAR PSU. Model fundamentally. It's a non-hydrostatic model, which means it can simulate the three-dimensional wind field. It may be basically downscale all the way to 1 kilometer spatial resolution, which makes it very desirable for downscaling coarse resolution data to the scale of any target watershed, and it is able to capture the impact of steep topography and land surface land use conditions over any target watershed, such as the American River watershed. So, there was a question earlier from the audience, you know, how do you relate the synoptic conditions to the local conditions of a target watershed? Well, the way you do it is basically you set up, you know, a sequence of nested model domains. one sets up first a very large domain, you know, in order to be able to translate the synoptic conditions. This particular domain in here is at 81 kilometer grid resolution, goes from roughly about 110 west to about 130 west longitude, and roughly about 33 degrees north to about 48 degrees north latitude. So it is a very large domain. Then what we do is we solve the whole dynamics and thermodynamics within this domain at 81 kilometer resolution, basically a three-dimensional, you know, dynamics and thermodynamics, just taking the synoptic conditions, the historical conditions from the reanalysis data along the boundaries, basically the important boundaries here, these are the inflow boundaries. And then after solving the whole event at 81 kilometers, then set up the second nest, which is basically using the conditions from this these results in simulating now the conditions at 27 kilometers, then another nest solving at 9 kilometers, another nest solving at 3 kilometers. What is, however, rather important is that this nesting procedure is not only one way. You can set it up in two ways so that the smaller, the child domains can also influence the mother domains. In other words, you can go both ways. So the way, you know, we did this exercise is we first tried to simulate the two-month historical conditions, the December 96 to January 97 conditions, in order to configure our model. Why configure a model? The reason why one ends up configuring a model is because a model like MM5 actually is made up of a set of many, many different options. There are many options for cumulus parameterization. What is this cumulus parameterization? What it is basically trying to relate the subgrid scale effects of deep convection and shallow convection on the large scale. Basically, you know, trying to get those interactions, meanwhile trying to resolve the subgrid scale precipitation when you are looking at, you know, the larger grid sizes. When you actually go down to the cloud, and within the cloud, you know, such as, you know, when one does simulations at 3 kilometer resolution, you get into the resolvable scale where one needs to then define a microphysics scheme. Then there are, again, you know, many different options. Similarly, there are many options for the planetary boundary layer and so on. So what we did is we tried all these different combinations to try to find the optimal, the best combination that's going to give us the closest results to the observations. And the case three, which is made up of the Kane-Frisch cumulus parametrization, the mixed phase Reisner 2, what's called as Reisner's Graubel cloud microphysics, and the medium range forecasting, eta medium range forecasting planetary boundary layer option came up to be the best option. So here we are looking at an example of the numerical atmospheric model computations at 27 kilometer grid resolution. These are historical simulations for the ground precipitation intensity during December 24, 96 to January 3, 97. We are seeing here the ground precipitation, and all those arrows that you are seeing are the surface wind field. And on the right-hand side, we are seeing the mean mixing ratio, the average mixing ratio throughout the atmosphere, along with the wind at 500 millibars and the wind at 890 millibars. One can clearly see the relationship between the moisture, the wind field, how they are interacting. Now, in here, we are now looking at the precipitation on the ground surface simulated by MM5, the atmospheric model at 3 kilometer resolution from December 24 to January 3 at 3 kilometer resolution to see, you know, the kind of the very fine precipitation fields over these three watersheds, the Feather, the Yuba, and the American. Then we basically compared the model reconstructed precipitation field. Here we are looking at the spatial distribution of the precipitation depth for the December 2006. Again, what is considered as the observed precipitation field, what is called as the prism field, which is basically made up of the interpolation of the of all the precipitation gauge depths, and then also incorporating the effect of topography. Comparing these two fields actually encouraged us. One thing that one can see, the distinct differences are actually over the high mountain tops, right in here, and right in here. And in those places, it is not clear whether the model is correct or the prism is correct. We tend to think that actually model is more realistic than prism, since model is accounting for, you know, the whole effect of the wind field and all the other atmospheric conditions rather than doing an extrapolation. Here we are looking at actually the actual comparison of the model simulated hourly precipitation during the modeling period versus the rain gauge or the precipitation gauge observations over American River. Again, what is really encouraging is how well, you know, the model was able to simulate the observations, except at those points. As it turns out, you know, these particular events were the events, you know, where we had missing observations, missing data. Aside from those missing data cases, actually the model did quite well in simulating the hourly precipitation at all these gauges, stations, precipitation stations that are pretty much distributed all over the watershed. Okay. And in here, we are looking at the hourly basin average precipitation. First, of course, trying to detect the historical 72-hour maximum precipitation depth, which took place during December 30, 96, noon to January 2, 97, June, and basically producing 13 inches. Here we are looking at the 72-hour historical precipitation depth, but with at different grid resolutions, here at 9 kilometer resolution, here at 3 kilometer resolution. One can clearly see a much better resolution for the spatial distribution of precipitation depth at 3 kilometer resolution. Within that framework, then we defined the maximization procedure as follows. Following up on the original ideas from the 1940 studies, the first step is to maximize the atmospheric moisture inflow to the model domain through the model outer domain boundary. Then the second step is to search for the optimal trajectory of the wind field toward the target watershed by moving the atmospheric river with respect to only latitude in this preliminary study. The third one is search for the optimal wind speeds along the model outer boundary, not done in this preliminary study. Combine the optimal moisture and wind conditions and repeat the exercise for all the historically recorded severe storms over California for the 72 hours duration. We have already seen this historical period. Then moving on, when one does the maximization by the relative humidity, basically maximizing the relative humidity at the inflow boundaries to 100%, then one ends up with the with a maximum 72-hour precipitation of about 18 inches, you know, for the 72-hour period right here. And in here, we are looking at basically the Again, the synoptic conditions, you know, from the reanalysis data on the left-hand side and the 3-kilometer model simulation, what is really important in here to see, you know, the evolution of this, what's called as this atmospheric river. One can see, you know, that river is not like, you know, the usual Sacramento River or, you know, American River. The river itself, you know, its width is continuously changing, and it is evolving. So there is no one fixed path and, you know, one fixed width, you know, for such rivers. So when one is accounting for this atmospheric river, you know, within the synoptic conditions as boundary condition to the modeling domain, one needs to really account, you know, for this variability. And plus also, please note the wind field. When we did this whole shifting of the atmospheric conditions in the north-south direction, actually we obtained some very interesting results. When one, just imagine fixing your boundary and then moving the historical atmospheric conditions either towards north or towards south. If you move those conditions in the northward direction, in the latitude-wise, say that, you know, you are moving the condition by, say, you know, 1.5 degrees, what you see is a reduction in the precipitation depth. What we found is when we move this, you know, the whole atmospheric river, you know, towards north, actually we decrease precipitation. When we moved, you know, the whole atmospheric river with all the atmospheric conditions towards south, then we obtained some very interesting results. What we found is that the precipitation depth over American River watershed, this is over American River watershed, actually increases up to about a 5-degree movement, southward movement. But once one exceeds that 5 degrees, go to 7.5 degrees, all the way to 12.5 degrees, in fact, by 12.5 degrees, actually one starts again going below the historical conditions. By this shifting process, actually we ended up with a maximum precipitation of 21.3 inches. And in here, we are looking at the whole, you know, summary of the whole simulation results. The maximization of the moisture basically gives 18 inches during a 72-hour period, whereas, you know, doing the basically maximizing the wind field, if you like, along the other conditions, produces 21.3 inches during a 72-hour period. So Gary asked me, he said, well, you know, maybe you should also consider, you know, putting these results into a frequency framework. So we did that. Just to put things, you know, into that framework, if you just consider the Roos curve here, one sees the following. One sees that for the shifting exercise result, which is 21.3 inches, one ends up, you know, with a 700-year return period. Now, on the other hand, if one only maximizes the moisture, one actually ends up with a 170-year return period. The historical conditions are right here. Now, putting this in the framework of the previous PMP studies, if one goes, you know, to the report number 36, which was done in 1961, which produced about 31.5 inches, it puts basically the return period to about 55,000 years. And the hydrometeorological report 59, which was in 1999, just produced about 29 inches, which gave a return period of about, on the Roos curve, about 16,000 years versus, you know, the other results. So basically, what we are doing is we are repeating the whole exercise for the various durations. And what we are doing is also combining the wind and the moisture conditions, you know, along with the wind speed conditions to look at, you know, the effect of the combined physical conditions. So in conclusion, This preliminary study demonstrates how the boundary conditions of a numerical atmospheric model can be modified in order to estimate the maximum 72-hour basin average precipitation over the American River watershed. We have already mentioned, you know, the preliminary studies, study results versus the existing PMP values. And other important issues to mention is that during a maximum precipitation event, not only the maximum precipitation depth, but also the information on the variation of precipitation rate, both respect to time and space over the target watershed, very important. Another very important aspect is the information on the other atmospheric variables that accompany this maximum precipitation event. Why are they important? Because in the ensuing hydrologic flow conditions, the other atmospheric factors, such as radiation, such as, you know, the atmospheric temperature, the wind field, are also very important. So the way we are approaching it is we are basically coupling a physically-based spatially distributed watershed hydrology model to the numerical atmospheric model of the maximum precipitation event, and using the output of the numerical atmospheric model in regard, you know, to the other atmospheric variables in order to basically simulate the corresponding flooding event. Where will it make a difference? Well, it will certainly make a difference in the way one would compute, for instance, the snowmelt through the energy balances, as the radiation balances, the radiation conditions are changing. Thank you very much. Yes, please.
Alan? Go to the microphone, please.
A comment and a question. The comment is that, again, we're seeing for the American River, just from what I saw here, that when you have a west-southwest flow, a fast west-southwest flow of the atmospheric river, that's when you get your maximum precipitation in the American watershed, but that if you move that same condition further to the north, you don't see that. My question is, what were the maximum 1 hour rain rates that the MM5 3 kilometer was coming up with? What did it give you?
Well, you know, I don't remember out of hand. Of course, you know, we did compute, you know, the whole, you know, the hourly precipitation, you know, as well. But in this particular study, you know, we were aiming to maximize, you know, the 72-hour storm. As you well know, if one looks at the same problem, you know, at different durations, there's no guarantee, you know, that one set of conditions are going to maximize, you know, all different durations. In other words, one can end up, you know, with different conditions, you know, for 24-hour storm versus a 48-hour storm versus a 72-hour storm, and so on.
The reason I ask that question is because our mountain RT model is showing above more than 5 inches in 6 hours in stable orographic rainfall. I don't know if that seems a bit low to me, but do you have data that corroborates that?
Yes, we have a lot of data. I mean, we need to go back and, you know, basically see, you know, what we have to, you know, answer your question. Yeah.
Okay. Have you mentioned that the models can send information both ways? The finer scale can contribute to the large scale, and large scale can define the small scale.
Yes.
I'm wondering, what effect?
Is it possible to write the light? The light.
What effect the landscape treatments have? And you mentioned that, you know, the snow melt is something you haven't fully defined yet in this output. But what can you tell us about how land treatment, you know, deforestation or paving of the watershed, those kinds of things, what influence will they have on flood events under these, and can that be depicted in these models, or is that something that falls outside these models?
Yeah, very good question. In fact, As far as you know, the topography is concerned, it's really important, you know, to basically run, you know, non-hydrostatic, you know, models, which means, you know, that the model is computing the vertical momentum explicitly, rather than approximating it, you know, by what is called as the hydrostatic approximation. That is necessary to be able to catch that orographic, you know, lift that you will see, you know, in the Sierra foothills. You know, these models can actually do a very good job, you know, in catching, you know, that wind, you know, the uplift, the orographic uplift. Coming back to your second question about, you know, the effect of the land surface conditions, that effect, you know, for short-term events is hard to distinguish. However, when one does climate simulations, such as, you know, like the climate change simulations that we also do, you know, for like a century, then you can really see, you know, their effects. What happens is that when you change, you know, the land surface, such as, you know, cutting, you know, the all the trees, whatnot, what happens is you are actually changing, you know, the what's called as the roughness height. You are changing, you know, the albedo. You can change the albedo. You can change, you know, the emissivity characteristics. In fact, you can also, you know, change, you know, the infiltration characteristics. For such simulations, then, you know, it is really necessary to have a fully coupled atmospheric hydrologic hydroclimate model. You know, so when we run these, you know, such studies, you know, to see the impact of the land surface, we are actually running them, you know, on a fully coupled, you know, atmospheric hydrologic model. Yeah.
That'd be a quick question. This is the last question.
Okay, I just want to follow up because your figure two shows quite a difference in some cases between the precip and the runoff. And so sort of along what Stefan just asked, is that primarily a snow melt phenomenon? Is that, of course, you know, over time, the land surface has changed in the watershed. So how would you account for the spread or the difference between the measured precip and the measured runoff in figure two?
Right. In fact, I was hoping to discuss that issue, you know, during the panel discussion, because that's actually a very important issue, you know, that you have raised. What is going on, you know, with the hydrologic regime, and how to address that? Maybe I like to defer, you know, your question, you know, to the panel.